Wouldn't my life be better if I just got a chance to do everything over again now that I know what I already know? Love seems to be intertwined with the notion of, is this the right person for me? You look at it as a lesson that taught you how to ultimately become the person that you are, and hopefully that's a better person. I see people who find a way to be happy while their daily challenge is to find water and food just enough to live. Your legacy is who you touch, who then will touch somebody else. And the way that you're remembered and the way that you go on is not how they cheer your name years later.
What do people get wrong when they think about regrets throughout their life? Mitch Albom, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Welcome back. It's great to have you. So, Mitch, we kick off with a big open question every time. I'm going to tweak it this time just for you. Who are you and what problem does your new book, Twice, solve for people?
Well, I am by name Mitch Albom. I am by occupation an author or a storyteller. And the problem that my new book solves is the haunting question of, wouldn't my life be better if I just got a chance to do everything over again now that I know what I already know? And we always assume that that's going to be a yes, but my book kind of explores, maybe it's more like a sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Okay, lovely. So talk us through the process. So when you first had this idea, where were you when that seed initially planted for you?
Well, for me, I write books a little bit differently, I think, than other people do. Ever since Tuesdays with Maury, which was a nonfiction book that I wrote that kind of, I guess for most readers and people in your audience, sort of put me on the map. That book was a nonfiction book, but it was broken down into different themes. You know, we talked about different subjects, my old professor who was dying and I, and each week was a different theme. And ever since then, when I've sat down to write even novels, I actually think of the theme first and the story second. So where I was when I thought about this is really probably not a question I can answer with a specific moment, because I've been thinking about this all my life. And that is, you know, what if you got a do-over, you know, and what if you got to erase a mistake? And then that turned into a whole story about, well, what if I create a character who actually has that power, and what happens when he starts using it? And then it led me to love, which becomes the overriding sort of theme in it. So books sort of develop with me, less so than, you know, some writers just get a plot and they say, I want to write a book about a guy who blows up shopping malls and a guy who, you know, pursues him, and they take it from there and they research shopping malls and terrorists and all that. And that's all great. For me, I try to get that theme and I say, what's the theme? And then I say, so, okay, how could I create a story that would address that theme? And as I say, I've been thinking about that theme for a long time, as I imagine maybe you have and some of the people who are listening to us have too.
And why do you think that love was so important to be kind of tied to this theme?
Well, because I think if we're being honest, that's one of the things we probably question ourselves about the most. When we're out searching for love at a young age, we're always wondering who's out there for me, right? And we start dating and it's like, well, is this person really the right person for me? Or maybe there's somebody better, you know? How long should I stay with this person? You know, is there a real future with this person? Or maybe somebody else would have a better future. And then, of course, if you look at the divorce rates, clearly about half of us who have decided to make commitments to one another have decided, no, you know what? I think I'd be better off with somebody else. And so love seems to be intertwined with the notion of, is this the right person for me? Or did I settle? Or did I act too quickly? Or has this person changed? Or would I be happier? And that's really the question, isn't it, Jack? Would I be happier under a certain different circumstance? And happiness is a funny thing, you know? as I've learned, as I've gotten older, it's really complicated. And so I wanted to explore the happiness that comes with love and whether, you know, jumping partners or switching to somebody else is the answer. And so in the book Twice, I made the caveat, the one exception to the magic that this lead character has, love. It doesn't work with love. And so if you are, someone's in love with you and you're married to them, you're dating them, whatever, and you decide, I just want to see what it's like with somebody else. And you go back and try that, that person who was in love with you can never love you again. It's all or nothing. So they'll be in the world, they'll be around, you can know them, but they can never love you again. So you're going to sacrifice that to go explore someone else's love, which isn't the way it works in the real world. A lot of the times, you know, we break up with people, they still stay madly in love with us for some strange reason, or you in love with them for some strange reason. But in this case, you make the decision, you pay the price. And that became, that's when the book really, to me, became really interesting.
There's a lovely book called The Paradox of Choice, where we struggle, where there's so many options out there. And I think for Alfie in the book, there's this like feeling of, well, what if I could just do that? What if I could try and be with somebody else? What have you learned about the feeling of being content as you've wrote this book?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question. It's at the heart of, you know, what I try to conclude with this book. And that is that, you know, there's a moment where his grandmother in the book, who also has this power, is talking to him, you know, as someone who has lived with it her whole life. And he says to her, well, why do we only get two chances? You know, why do we have to live with the consequences of our second chance, which is the rules of the power? Why don't we get more chances? And she says, Alfie, if you kept getting second chances, you wouldn't learn a damn thing. And that's the truth of it, is that if we just keep getting do-overs, we're always going to think that something else is better. It's the buffet syndrome. You ever go to a buffet, you know, and all you can eat, and it's like, I'll take some of that, and I'll take some of that, and I'll take some of that. You know, suddenly you don't want one thing. You want everything because it's all out there in front of you. Whereas if you go to another restaurant, you never think of ordering six things, right? When you're at a, when you go to a regular restaurant, you never say, well, I'll have the chicken, I'll also have a steak, I'll also have this, because I just want to taste all of them. But you go to a buffet and you go, I can have them all, I'll take them all. And so there's something to be learned from that buffet lesson. That is, you know, if you can be content with the choice that you made, and by being content, I don't mean settling, I mean finding the best in that choice and not thinking about another choice would be better. Enjoying the chicken instead of thinking, well, this chicken's good, but I bet the steak is better. You know, that haunting thing that you do to yourself, you'll be much happier. But it's, and it's really the people, my observation of happiness as I've gotten older and traveled around the world and gotten a chance to meet so many different people from so many different walks of life, is that the people who have the most are frequently the least happy people that I meet. And the people whose choices are pretty simple are amongst the happiest and most content. So there is not a correlation between having a gazillion choices in life and happiness. And that's one of the things I try to explore in Twice.
And then it feels like there's definitely, like, one of the big themes is regrets. So what have you learned about, what do people get wrong when they think about regrets throughout their life?
Well, I learned this from Maury many, many years ago at his bedside as he was dying, that, you know, it would say to me, don't get hung up on your regrets. They'll haunt you. And when you get to the end of your life, you're not going to want to be thinking about all the things that you didn't do or should have done. You'll want to appreciate the things that you did. And I think that if you look at everything, like, I've been asked since this book has, you know, become known, Well, what about you? Would you do anything over in your life twice? And I think a lot of people expect me to say, oh no, you know, I've learned I'm wizened and I would just leave everything alone. And I immediately say, hell yeah. You know, I can give you 20 right now that I would do over if I was given the chance, because I got it wrong the first time. But if you said to me, in doing them over and getting a second chance, you would have to unlearn what you learned from making the mistake, then I would say no, because everything that you regret taught you something, and everything that you missed out on led you to act differently when you had another chance. And everything that you should have done under one circumstance in some way led to the things that you did do later on. So I think if you can look at a regret as, instead of feeling, you know, oh, I should, life would just be so much better if I could undo it, you look at it as a lesson that taught you how to ultimately become the person that you are, and hopefully that's a better person, then you learn to almost cherish the things that went wrong and what you would have initially referred to as a regret. I'll give you a perfect example. I did not have, my wife and I did not have children when we got married. She wanted to have children. I was in that career mode. We were right on the cusp of the years where you can have kids. We got married pretty late. And, you know, we tried, but didn't happen. And we didn't, you know, I didn't start early enough, maybe, you know, we didn't start early enough. And at the time, I thought that that's what I wanted, you know. And years later, I came to regret not having children. However, 16 years ago, I was led by fate, I believe, to Haiti after the earthquake, and ended up working with an orphanage, and ended up becoming involved in the orphanage and taking over the operations of the orphanage, and now have so many children in my life, I don't know what to do with them. I've got 22 of them that live with me right now as I'm talking to you, as college is, you know, because the summer, they haven't gone back to college yet. And then they go to school around here. They've come up and gone to school. And we've adopted a little three-year-old girl. Well, she was 6 months when we adopted her. And I would not have done that, I don't think, if I had had children of my own. I would have been probably so busy with them and raising them that that opportunity probably would have just seemed like too much or too much to take on. So I could sit there and regret the fact that I didn't have children, or I could say, well, you know, the fact that I didn't probably made me gravitate towards them later in life and appreciate this second chance that I got at them. And really, you know, I like to think I'm a pretty good dad at this age, you know, might not have been back at that age. So it's just a small personal example of how, you know, something that you regret led you to do other things later in your life that you're happy had happened. So I think everyone can kind of find an example like that if they look.
I guess if I was to bet money on it, Mitch, I would say that you are an optimist through and through. I might be wrong, but that's kind of how you strike me. So then for some people, and you've probably met these people in your life, they struggle to let go of the mistakes that they've made. I guess from your personal experience, why do you think people struggle so much to not find the lesson in maybe the mistakes or the other paths that they could have taken?
Well, it's a, you know, it's more of a psychiatrist's answer than an author's, but I think the likelihood is that some people become comfortable with misery, and they're more comfortable with misery than happiness. And sometimes it's not all out misery. It's just sort of a general state of being unhappy, but for whatever reason, they don't feel they're worthy of happiness. They don't feel like they've known it. Maybe their parents didn't show it to them. And so their comfort zone is being unhappy. And no matter what happens, they always end up finding a way to tumble back into, you know, either depression or unhappiness or whatever, because that's where they're at. And when that happens, you know, they need to talk to somebody about why does this pattern keep repeating? Because the world can be a wonderful place. It can be. And I have seen, I have been blessed, Jack, to work in the most or second most impoverished place in the world. I'm in Haiti every month for the last 16 years. It is the poverty there is unlike anything, certainly in the Western Hemisphere. It's the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. And I see people who find a way to be happy while their daily challenge is to find water and food just enough to live. And yet there's smiles and there's singing and there's laughter and there's prayer and all that. How is that possible? How it proves that it's not about what you have. It's about something inside you. And so the people who are always defaulting to unhappiness, and I count amongst them people who are famous and rich and well-known, you know, I know a lot of them who still find their way to be unhappy with, from the outside, almost everything that anyone could dream of. So I think, you know, people have to look into their histories, their upbringing, all that, but it's something that people should explore and try to solve, because you don't have to. The world is not making you unhappy. The world provides happiness possibilities everywhere, you know, if you just manage.
And it felt like in the book there were themes of, we have paths in life that we can take. Maybe the best idea I can think of is maybe when it comes to like careers and maybe pursuing dreams, whether it be music or the arts and things like that. A lot of the time people will go down the safer path or the path that is expected as from maybe parents or guardians. What can you tell us about kind of following your dreams in that sense?
Yeah, that's another thing that I talked a lot about with Maury. And really, when I was a kid in college, Maury was kind of the first person who he took me seriously when I said, you know, I wanted to be a musician. I think up to that point, whenever I told any adults in my life that I wanted to be a musician, they looked at me as like, well, yes, of course, that's what a kid would say. But, you know, when you grow up, when you get to college, when you get out, you're going to want a real profession, you know. And he encouraged me to go into music, which I did. And I'm glad that I did, even though I failed at it from a, you know, commercial point of view, because I tried it. And I think it would haunt me if I didn't try it. And I think when people have these dreams of the unsafe kind of career versus the safe career, the time to try it is when you're young, and you should try it. If you fall, it's like a kid who's just learning to walk. They're so close to the ground to begin with. It doesn't hurt, right? You know, but when you're fully grown and you take a tumble, you know, you break something. So early in your career path, or you're right out of school, that's a great time to try any of those things. And if you like it, or if you hit on it, if it works out for you, great, you've got a life. If you don't, you still got lots of time to go and try something else. But what happens is there's a lot of pressure, and certainly here in the States, there's a lot of pressure on kids today to know what they want to do before they even get out of college, or before they even get out of high school, to have a career path and a profession chosen and have it safe or whatever. And they do that because that's kind of what they're taught. And they go into it and they start to, you know, they get an advanced degree and they get the starting entry-level job and they work up and they get all the accoutrements that come with it. And somewhere in their 40s, they go to a jazz club and watch a guy blow a trumpet and say, you know, that's always what I wanted to do. And now it's too late, you know, now all this on. I never had that feeling of too late because I tried it when I was younger, you know, and I know what it was like. I know the pluses and the minuses of it. So I would encourage anybody who's thinking of the unsafe path or the less secure path to try it when you're unencumbered, when you're not married, when you don't have kids depending on you and all that, and give it a go. And the worst that could happen is you fail, but it'll still serve you well later in life, you know, when you say, geez, didn't, someone says to you, didn't you always want to be a musician? Yeah, I did. You know, I tried it. Didn't work out. But I got, you know, I kind of saw what that life would have been like. And I kind of like the life I have right now.
How did you know when to pivot?
That's a really good question. When I found something else, and I found something else by accident. So I was a musician. First I was a musician through college, and you know, I went to college, but I played on weekends and whatever I could in bands, and you know, I was setting myself up. And then I went to Europe, and I was a musician there for a stretch of time, particularly in Greece. And then I came back to New York City, and I did the whole starving musician thing, and went from club to club and record company to record company. And in fact, there's a couple scenes in the book, because Alfie in the book, the protagonist, also starts out as music. And there's a moment where he thinks he's written this great song, and he goes in and he sits down across from this record company executive, and they put on his tape, and he hits play. And just as he hits play, the guy's phone rings, and the guy picks up the phone, doesn't shut the music off, talks through the whole song. And just as the song ends, he hangs up. He goes, "Nah, I don't hear it." And that's word for word what happened with me one time with a guy in a record company. You know, I said, "What do you mean you don't hear it? You were on the phone the whole time." So, while I was a musician, I worked mostly at nights. And so one day I was in a supermarket, and I picked up this local newspaper that they, you know, handed out for free. And it had a little ad on it that said, if you have free time, we could use some help putting out this newspaper. And since I worked mostly at nights and had, you know, a regular schedule, I said, well, I'm not doing anything. And so I went down there, and they gave me an assignment. The very first time I showed up, I was the youngest person by about 60 years. So I think I was the only one who was mobile enough to go do it. But they sent me out to cover like a little local community meeting about parking meters or something. And I'd never written anything really before in my life, but I was always a good storyteller, and I was always pretty creative. And so I, you know, went there like Woodward and Bernstein. I had a little notepad, and I asked a lot of really hard questions about parking meters, you know, wrote things down. And then I wrote a story, you know, and I gave it to them. And the next week I went to the supermarket, and the paper came out, and they put it in my little bag. And there was my story on the bottom of the front page, which only shows you how little news there was in that particular part of New York. But I got that little tingle that you get when you see your name on something that you created, you know. And I said, I went back, wrote another story, and went back, wrote another story. I worked there for 6 months for free, never got paid. And then after 6 months of like pretty much working there every day, they said, well, you're here all the time, so we're going to give you some money. We gave me $25 a week. And I worked another 6 months for $25 a week, but I learned about writing. And I learned about, in that case, journalism. And I learned that I had some aptitude for it. And when I found something that was rewarding yet creative, I was able to sort of, I liken it to like swinging on a vine, you know, like you take your momentum from one vine and then you start looking for another one, but you don't let go of the one you're on until you find one that's safe to grab, you know. And writing became this safe vine for me to grab, and I let go of music and started swinging on the writing vine, and I've been doing it ever since.
I think it's, and I mean, it's so fitting with the book, Mitch, because the body doesn't know the difference. I used to do music 10 years ago now, and we were on the up, and then all of a sudden you hit that decline. And you're like, oh, time to pivot. Mm-hmm. So that's where the question came from. But I think about like the body doesn't know the difference in terms of that little feeling that you got when you saw your name on the article is probably the same feeling that you got when you perform a song to a room. And I guess as you look back now on the success that you've had with the books and all those things, but more so probably the ripples of you don't know whose hand those books have ended up in. And actually, there could be another version of Mitch that's playing boozy little clubs on a Friday, Saturday night. But actually, you don't know probably the effect that the books have had. I want to really dive into love with you, Mitch, because obviously that is one of the big themes of the book. I guess maybe a tough question. Do you truly believe that love the second time around can work?
Oh, 100%. Yes, I think love is a learned art as much as it is a feeling. You know, it's like a fire. Okay, a fire. There's all forms of fire. What is undeniable about a fire is that there's ignition and there is flame. But after that, how that fire grows, how long it lasts, all the rest of it, that's circumstantial, right? That's not the element of fire itself. It's everything around it. Love is the same way. You know, yes, you need to have that, at least to me, you need to have that combustion and ignition and that entity. But after that, whether it grows or goes out, whether it turns into a roaring thing, whether it destroys or whether it's controlled, that's all what you do with it and how you nurture it. And I think sometimes people have that ignition, that flame, young in their life. They don't know what they're doing. They end up blowing it out. And the second time around, if they get a second time around, they're much more careful with it and they handle it correctly. They blow on it when it needs to be blown on. They let it breathe when it does. And it becomes a much different thing. So, yeah, there's no question to me that you can love more than once. You know, especially people who have it. In fact, it's not an accident, I don't think, that people who have happy marriages, statistically, it shows when one of them dies or, you know, is widowed, the other one marries rather quickly. And you would think, well, how can that be if it was such a perfect love they had and they had this amazing love story, why would they go marry somebody else? But that's exactly the reason, because they are comfortable being in love and they are comfortable knowing love and sharing love, and the world is quite empty without it. And so they search for it in another person, and because they know how to keep those embers going and they know what good love looks like, they're able to find it with somebody else. Whereas people who are miserable when they're married for the first time and then get divorced or somebody dies, they often don't remarry again because I don't want to go through that again. You know, like, oh God, that was bad enough the first time. I don't want to have to deal with that. So yeah, I absolutely believe that you can love multiple times. But I also think, and you know, I don't want to spoil the book for anybody, but you know, Alfie meets this girl when he's a little boy in Africa, and you know, she's like the first girl in his life, and meets her again many years later and seems to feel like they're fated. I mean, the book is really this love story about the two of them, and their lives kind of go like this and back and forth and crisscross each other. And I also believe in that. You know, I believe that there can be this one person that you were sort of, you just line up with. And, you know, people always say, but okay, I live in, you know, Detroit, Michigan, and what if there's somebody in Madagascar who's just like perfect for me? And I go, yeah, well, what if there's somebody in, you know, Wales who's perfect for you? What if there's someone in New Zealand? How long are you going to do that? You know, you're going to spend your whole life just tramping the globe because you want to cover all the territories to make sure that you've checked out your possibility. That's what I mean by, you know, so much of love is more about what you do to that fire than where you find it, you know? And I try to get that across in Twice.
Mm. And then part of the marketing campaign around the book has been beautiful, because I've seen it all over social media. You've had people sending their love stories in, and these are there any like examples that come to mind from any of the stuff?
What we're seeing a lot of, and we're encouraging people to just sort of send these because they really help sell the book or anything, but I just think it's kind of a cute community to kind of, you know, whip up into getting to know one another, with the book as, I guess, a reason to do it. You find a lot of stories about people who, you know, they were in love when they were younger. It was during the war, or they were in college. And then for some reason, circumstances took them apart and they married somebody else, had a family, raised a family, lived some, moved away, but they never stopped thinking about that person, you know, and then somehow they were widowed or they got divorced or whatever. And then they ran into them again and it was like nothing had ever changed. And boom, they ended up within 6 weeks we were married, within 6 days we were married, you know, and we've been together ever since. I can't believe how many stories there are like that, you know, because if those are the ones that we're getting sent in, I can only imagine how many are out there that, you know, people just aren't on social media or aren't sending in stories. So apparently it happens a lot. And especially early loves that you never sort of stop thinking about, you know, that seems.
And there's this like through line of, I guess, waiting for things to be perfect for Alfie. So Alfie in the book is thinking about like, oh, I want it to be perfect. I want to be the right person for them. I might not want to say it necessarily. What have you learned about just being authentic and just diving into love head first?
Well, if you want things to be perfect, you're not being honest, because there is no such thing as perfection. So if you are waiting for perfection, you're not really being honest with the other person about who you are, or you're hiding your flaws or whatever. And I think the roots of a good love are honesty, even about your faults. Like, hey, I'm not good at this. I need help. Or I'm not comfortable with this kind of thing. I'm probably not going to be. Or I prefer to stay in instead of doing all those things. Can we figure out a way that we can coexist, you know, doing that? Rather than always trying to, you know, like yelling over, you always make me do this, or you're always this, or you're always that, you know. And so waiting for perfection in any relationship, even in a deep love affair, is like waiting for Godot. I mean, it's just going to be left at the train station, you know. And so Alfie, I chose the name Alfie because I don't suspect that there's that many people who saw the movie back in the 60s who are still around. but I did, not in the 60s. I saw it like 10 years ago. And it's a, I always thought that I had known I was a child in the 60s, so I wasn't allowed to go see that movie or anything like that. But I knew about it, and I had heard that it was about like a playboy. And I always thought that because of that song, What's It All About Alfie, you know, I always thought, well, he was probably this happy-go-lucky playboy and you know, women were always falling in love with him and all, and it was all great and you were on his side. But when I watched it, it was miserable. It was a terrible movie. I mean, it was well acted and everything, but the guy was pathetic and he was such a louse, and he cheats on his best friend, his mate's. He sleeps with his mate's wife, and it's like nobody's off limits to him. And he ends up alone, you know, and he's miserable. And I thought, here's a guy who sort of always thought the next girl is going to be better, and the next one's going to be better, and the next one's going to be better. And look how miserable he is. And so I thought, well, I'm going to call this guy Alfie, just because that movie kind of resonated with me about the whole second chance in love thing. And in the book, he also, because he's named Alfie, he always hears that song being sung to him, you know, wherever he goes. Oh, Alfie, what's it all about? Alfie, you know, yeah. Okay. Again. But he never sees the movie, and he only sees it at the end when it plays a particular part in his development and his story. And so it gave me kind of an interesting backdrop. So, you know, like the Alfie character in the movie, waiting for perfection in the woman you love is foolhardy and almost an insult to the women you are seeing, because it's basically saying, yeah, you're close, you know, but like, you know, like, uh, like a certain president who rates the women by numbers. You know, you're a seven. You're not bad, but that's not 10. You know, so.
Do you think it's the modern world that we're living in that is driving this loneliness epidemic of people struggling to be content? Or do you think actually it's always been this way? That's humanity and people always want the grass on the side.
I mean, I think the idea of grass is always greener goes back to, I did some research on that quote for the book, and it goes back to the ancient Greeks. That's who came up with that, the grass is always greener. So apparently we have been feeling this way for a long time, but I do think it's way worse now because of this, this has changed everything. And, you are constantly being shown images of people who seem eminently happier than you. If you think about it, it's because they're picking the images and they're only putting up the ones that make them look happy, because they too feel like everyone else is happier than me, so I need to put my happy image up there. I remember reading once about People magazine when it was formed. Is People magazine still a thing? I think it's still out there, right? I'm not a magazine reader, but I remember when it was formed, it was kind of a new sort of concept. And they said, someone in an article I was reading said that the idea of it was to make readers envious of the people that they were reading about, that they would feel like their lives were somehow better. And that was the catnip that got people to read. And that was the angle. So you didn't have to necessarily make news to be in it. You just had to be able to present yourself in a way that would make the reader envious. And I always thought that was weird. It's like, wow, you're selling envy, basically you're that's your product. But it worked, it became a massively successful magazine. And I think that that's what this is about too, is the internet and social media just makes everybody quietly envious of everybody else. And that's why everyone's so angry. And that's why this also becomes a vestibule for so much vitriol and so much hatred, because, who wants their nose rubbed in the fact that someone else is doing better? Someone else is on a vacation. Someone else is happier. Someone else, look how much weight they lost. Look at how great their makeup is. Look at it. Nobody puts on, look how fat I got. Nobody puts on, look how ugly I am in the morning. It's always everybody tailors it and edits it and changes the lighting until they look perfect. And then they put it on there, and then you're on there like, well, how come I don't look like that? And so it's, especially if you're young, this idea develops like, I must keep up with this. I have to keep up with this. I have to keep up with this. And I think that that's the difference. Yes, there's always been a grass is always greener thing. But sometimes when you lived in a small community where you didn't know about other people's rich and famous lives and all the, think of that show, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. What an idea, that someone came up with the same concept as the People magazine. Let's just come up with stuff that makes people envious. Ooh, look at how they're living. It's not, no one's ever happy for those people. They're always like, I wish I had that. Or look at that guy. He doesn't even appreciate what he has. So I think media has really exacerbated loneliness. And, the loneliest city I ever lived in was New York City, and that's where the most people were. So you would think, well, if you got the most people to pick from, wouldn't that be the least lonely place? But it's not, and the least lonely place I've ever been is our orphanage at Haiti, where everybody is living in abject poverty, but they're all right around one another. And we all know each other's lives, and we don't have anything to do at night that's exciting, and we don't have electricity most of the day, and we're lucky if we have water 2 or 3 hours a day whenever, but we find things to do with one another, I do think it's worse now than it has been in the past.
So what do you think, Mitch, if we gave you the powers for one day, and that could maybe be your next book, but if you had the powers, how do you think you could get people to be happier with the choices that they've made throughout their life?
Well, number one, I'd make everybody get rid of these. Gone. For that one day, there is no internet and there is no phones. And then the second thing I would do is wherever you are in your life, whatever station you are in your life, you find someone who's doing much worse than you and you go spend time with them and do something to help them. I know in every fiber of my being and with every fiber of my existence that that changes your life. When you give to other people, you live. You there's no substitute for it. When I, you know, get calls from people who say, oh, I'm really depressed. You know, what do you think I should do? I said, is there a soup kitchen near you? Is there a homeless shelter near you? Is there an orphanage near you? Is there anything like that? Oh, yeah. Go on down. Just go down and spend 2-3 hours down there and tell them you want to help out. Oh, why do I want to do that? I said, just go. And then call me back. And sure enough, you know, they go and they go, wow, okay, I get it, you know. And it's not about someone else is doing worse than me, so now I feel better. Not at all. It's about someone else is doing worse than me and I can help them do better. And you find a sense of purpose in your existence that not only gives you that, you know, raison d'etre, but also makes you forget about the problems that you had that seemed so overwhelming before. So if I were king of the world for a day, which I will never be, and that's a good thing, those are the two things I would do. Disconnect so you can't compare, and then go out and find someone in a worse situation than you and help them. And that would set a pattern for the day that I'm no longer the king, come Tuesday, you know, whatever, that people might say, you know what, I'm going to do what I did on Monday. I'm going to do that same thing. I'm going to stay disconnected. I'm going to try to help somebody else out. And I think it would make a big difference in the world.
I think it would make a big difference. There's a, what did they say? I was angry at the world that I had no shoes until I met the man with no feet. So right. I think gratitude helps. So I think this kind of leads on nicely and wraps it up, Mitch. In terms of the book, Alfie could do anything. He could go back twice, so he could make so many mistakes, and he did exciting things like swimming with the sharks and climbing in the lion's cage. What, in a world where you can probably do anything, but actually at the fundamentals of it, it is a love story. What do you truly think about legacy? So when we're no longer here on this planet, what do you think that legacy means?
I think it means the lives that you touched while you were here, that not just, because we're all going to be forgotten. It doesn't matter. You know, there's a lovely poem. I think it's called The Forgotten, but it's about a man who's walking through a cemetery and he hears the voices of the people who are buried in the ground. And he hears them wailing and crying, and he talks to them about why are you upset? And they say, well, we are awaiting the second death. And he says, what's the second death? And the second death is when we are forgotten, when nobody is left on the planet to speak our name or remembers who we were. And, you know, unless you're Genghis Khan or Michael Jackson, you know, you're going to be forgotten in a matter of generations, you know, fewer than you think. Do you know your great, great grandparents' name? No. I don't either. So, and that's our family. So that's just four generations. So I think it's your legacy is who you touch, who then will touch somebody else. And the way that you're remembered and the way that you go on is not how they cheer your name years later, but how the people that you influence others. And when you really think about it, that's a far greater legacy than someone saying, you know, I remember Mitch Albom, you know, he wrote a bunch of books. But if this little girl that we're raising now goes on to become an important person who influences her children or somebody she works with, who influences somebody else because of things that I taught her and my wife taught her, that's touching the world, right? And that's like a, you know, a pebble in a lake that you throw in, and then the ripples start coming back towards the shore, and you just don't ever realize, you know, how many people you're going to influence. And I think, you know, if I've done that with any of my stories, if I've made somebody think twice, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, well, Tuesdays with Maury, you know, really affected me, or Five People You Meet in Heaven made me look at, you know, the death of my such and such differently, and I have a different attitude. Or sometimes people tell me they got back in touch with family members or things like that after they read a story of mine. I think, okay, well, that was a life that I touched, and, you know, kind of go on. And that's enough of a legacy. I don't, people think like they have to know their legacy. They have to be able to trace it. And I think it's more interesting to just sort of throw that pebble in the lake and then just wonder how many ripples are out there, you know. And you don't need to write a book to do that. Even just go help somebody, you know, just make a difference in somebody's life, and they'll make a difference in somebody else's.
And the way that you're talking about the second death there, Mitch, I think like that's one way to think of it. And I think that's the mantra for life, of knowing that actually you won't be here for long. So go out, love audaciously, live, try not to let regrets hang you down. And the book is beautiful. I remember, I think it was early 2024 where we sat and we spoke about your last book. I remember it because I went home that night and my partner went into labor, and I said, I'm so glad that you've waited so I could do the Mitch conversation. And we spoke about, I said, what books have you got left to write? And we spoke about my favorite film being It's a Wonderful Life. And you said, there's this other one about Imagine If You Got to Do Things Twice. And I would it's a beautiful love story. I would recommend that anybody listen to this. I'm sure they've already bought it, read it, and now they're absorbing everything on the internet. What else have you got left to say about Twice that hasn't been said already?
Well, I don't hear what's said about it so much. So, I live in kind of a bubble. You know, for me, it was a love story to my wife. And, you know, I wasn't always a perfect husband or mate or whatever. I've had so many flaws, and I read it to her. My wife, I think I've read, I don't think my wife has actually physically read a single one of my books, because our routine is that when I get close to the end, she'll say, okay, you ready to read it to me? And I'll read it to her in this room where we're at right now, where I'm at. And I'll sit just over here, and she'll sit just here so we can't see one another, because the last thing you want to do if you're reading a book to your wife is to look up and see her go. And make some face. So you don't want to see her reaction. And I read it to her, and the love story between Alfie and Gianna goes through quite a bit. And if you were to just stop in the middle, or stop at the 2/3 port, or stop the 3/4 point, you might think it's not going to be a happy ending. And when I got to the end of the book and she saw how it ended, which I'm not going to tell everybody, but it's a surprise kind of ending. She kind of, you know, leaned over and grabbed me and gave me a kiss and kind of teared up. And that was the best part for me, was that, you know, I was able to sort of show that even with second chance opportunities, real love means you probably would end up choosing to keep things the way they are, you know, even if you know there's a world of possibility out there. But if you had to forget and lose what you had, you know, it wouldn't be worth it to trade it in. I always say, people ask me about marriage, and as if I'm some kind of, you know, I don't know why they would ask me, but, you know, I get asked a lot of questions I don't deserve to be asked. I think once you write Tuesdays with Maury, they all think I'm Maury, you know. You know, I was the stupid one, remember? I was the dumb one in the quest. They'll ask about marriage, especially people who are getting married. And the only advice that I have for them that I think is worth a hoot is, I say, you know, there's three partners in a marriage. There's, you know, the husband, traditional marriage, you can use whatever, husband, wife, and the marriage itself. I said, and you need to love all three, because there's going to be times you're not going to be so crazy about your partner, but you need to be crazy about your marriage. And if you are, that'll carry you through the times where you're maybe not so crazy about one another. And my wife and I have a wall up in our kitchen of all these pictures from just different moments in our lives. They're just, you know, it's mostly family and at this thing or that thing or the other thing, and our arms around each other doing this or, you know, and this and that. And there are many times where that wall has kind of, you know, I don't want to saved our marriage. We weren't ever on the rocks like that, but, you know, that was where I would go and stand and look at it when I was less than thrilled with her, or she was less than thrilled with me, and say, yeah, but look at all this, you know, look at all this that we've done. And I'm in love with this too, you know, and I would never lose this, and I would never trade this in. And if you can find that third, you know, amorphous partner in your relationship, that, you know, whether it's marriage or if you're not married, it's just a relationship, then you have something special. And that's kind of, if you read twice, in the end, that's sort of one of its conclusions, that you could have a million possibilities, but if you have one really great love, you don't need a million other possibilities. You make the best of the one that you have, and you love the chance that you had.
Thank you, Mitch. Thank you so, so much. It's always an honor to host you and converse with you. If people want to buy the book or find you or get in touch, what's the best way to go about that?
Well, the book's hopefully everywhere, in your bookstores or Amazon or anything. And you can always find me on all the social media stuff, MitchAlbum.com and Instagram and YouTube and all that kind of business. And I do read the notes that people send me, and I do try to respond to them privately sometimes when people DM me or things like that. So don't feel like it's going into some black hole. It never does. I don't always and can't always get back to everybody who says something, but, you know, if it's something important, I usually try to respond to them. And now I need to know, is there a baby that's due at the end of this conversation? Because I don't know if that's a pattern.
Hopefully not at the end of this conversation.
Yeah, not that you're aware of.
No, there's another baby, but we've got till the end of the year. So hopefully I'm not getting a call. Yeah, yeah. We need a TV in our house or something to distract us. But thank you so, so much, Mitch. It's always an honor.
Sure. It's a pleasure, Jack. Thank you.